To give today's guest, Dr. Roger Chvil, optimal time, let me just introduce him as a passionate researcher, medical doctor, and professor, demystifying medical concepts. Today, it's all about light. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Roger, you'd be very proud of me. I woke up this morning and did a reset for my circadian rhythm after hearing some of your information.
Wonderful.
Got up and got into some of that early morning light. And there's so much we could focus on, but with 30 minutes, let's talk about light in relation to optimizing the immune system. And let's start with the information you shared off mic that many of today's diseases are strongly related to the fact that people are indoors for the most part and are not getting that full spectrum light.
Yeah, so full-spectrum light is often used to describe the amount of light that you can see, but there's even something beyond that. There is light that you cannot see from the sun, and that is in the ultraviolet range, which is important for vitamin D and things of that nature, but also on the other extreme, the infrared that you cannot see. And that's, we experience that not by seeing the light, but by feeling it. So if you were to go outside and put your back to the sun, you would feel that very warm feeling that even penetrates through your clothes, and you can feel that deep down in your skin. That's near-infrared radiation, and so the visual light has benefits, the ultraviolet light has benefits, and the near-infrared, which makes up more than 50% of the energy from the sun, also has tremendous benefits.
So should we focus a little bit on that infrared light then? And it seems like, yes, the infrared light does hold key to health benefits, but am I correct in thinking that maybe it's not necessarily that, but having the entire spectrum, so certain things go missing if the infrared is not there or not getting absorbed into the body, but it's the importance of the overall.
Yeah, exactly. So there are a number of important aspects of it. We in science like to break things down and look at their individual parts. But the amazing thing that I keep seeing in the body is that everything sort of works together. But for the ease of description, let's talk about near-infrared. So this is the spectrum of light that you cannot see. It penetrates very deeply. And because of that, near-infrared light is able to come in to the atmosphere from the sun, even when the sun is very low in the sky. So that's the first thing I want to talk about. Some people believe that in the wintertime, the sun is low in the sky, they're not getting adequate. That's not correct. When the sun is low, like at sunrise and at sunset, there is less, but still plenty of near-infrared radiation because it's able to penetrate at that angle through the atmosphere. So because it's able to do that, it's able to penetrate your skin, go deeply, and it goes to a portion of your cells in your body called the mitochondria. Now, the mitochondria are these organelles in each of your cells, except for the red blood cells, that produce energy. And this is the key, I think, for a lot of it, because energy production in your body, just like an engine in a car, gives off byproducts that need to be taken care of. So in a car, when the engine is running, it gives off heat. And if you don't deal with that heat, you can cause the engine to shut down. That's why you have a cooling system. That's why you have oil. Same thing in the mitochondria. The mitochondria are busily making energy from food that you eat. It's called ATP. That's the energy. But in the process of making that energy, your mitochondria give off substances which are very damaging to the mitochondria itself, of course. And they're called reactive oxygen species or hydroxy radicals or oxidative stress. There's a number of different terms for this. And what scientists are discovering is that there is a system in place, just like you have an oil system in your car or a cooling system in your car for your engine. There is a cooling system in the mitochondria, and specifically, it's called melatonin. Now, you may be saying, wait a minute, melatonin. I thought that was the sleep medicine that people take at night, and it's secreted from the pineal gland in the brain. We could talk more about that. That's important, too. But what scientists are now discovering is that 95% of the melatonin in your body actually doesn't come from your pineal gland. It's actually made on site in the mitochondria, and it's a powerful antioxidant that mops up all of these reactive oxygen species to protect your mitochondria from the damage. That is what some scientists are believing. We definitely know about the melatonin that's produced. What we're connecting now is this connection between near-infrared radiation that we get from the sun and the step-up in production of melatonin at the mitochondrial level.
And this research is relatively recent. You also had called the diseases of today a mitochondrial disease, and you've just certainly described why that is. And considering it is such new-ish information, it's surprising to me because, of course, the body would have a way to make the melatonin all day long rather than just in the pineal gland, right?
Yes, well, the body would need some sort of antioxidant because these reactive oxygen species are so reactive that they literally only need to travel just a few angstroms or very small amount of distance in the cell before they'll reach some protein that's important to the body, and they will denature it, and they will cause it to become dysfunctional. And so you're absolutely right. This is brand new, relatively recently discovered information. Russell Ryder, who's the executive of Melatonin Research, the journal, headed up some of this research, along with Scott Zimmerman, who I've been in communication with on this. And they have published this just recently in Melatonin Research. And there's a number of other groups that are working on melatonin, of course. But it is new research. It's not something that we didn't know. We have had decades, maybe even a century. If you go back a century, we've known that sun exposure, natural light exposure, is beneficial in a number of different ways. It reduces metabolic syndrome, diabetes. There's even rules at the federal level that when you make a school, there has to be certain size windows to let in natural light because we know that students learn better in those environments. And that's all related to mitochondria. So if you go to the Cleveland Clinic website, and you look at the list of diseases that have been tied to mitochondria, it really reads as the diseases that we see in the Western world. So we see diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, autism, Parkinson's disease. All of these diseases are related to the mitochondria.
Well, it's kind of brilliant because recently I've been reading up on nitric oxide, and there's a big relevance to diabetes. Here, reading your information, lo and behold, it helps in that situation. It helps the body to produce more nitric oxide.
Absolutely, yes. In fact, scientists are even using this now to show when they beam near-infrared lasers into the body, they can actually watch the vasculature dilate and open and expand and allow more perfusion, tissue perfusion. And they have shown that this is actually related through nitric oxide, which is a potent vasodilator.
Can you help us differentiate near infrared and then there's far infrared? And many people are familiar with the far infrared saunas.
Yeah, so near infrared is just past that range there of red. So that's 760 nanometers, and it goes all the way up to 1400. And then far infrared is just beyond that. So it's a different part of the spectrum. Practically speaking, when you buy these things or buy lamps or go into saunas like this, there is going to be a little bit of overlap. Specifically with melatonin research and the mitochondria, we are looking at the near-infrared spectrum.
So when we are looking at all of the light therapies that are being researched now, does that involve mostly the near-infrared light then?
Well, it's all over the spectrum. There is some data on far infrared, but most of the data is concentrating on near infrared,
okay.
Specifically in the clinical aspects of it. There are so many aspects to this; it's unreal. So, let me tell you about some research that was just published a number of months ago about COVID-19, which is something obviously that's in the news. So, we know that COVID-19 is a virus. But what we learned pretty early on was that there's an aspect of the viral infection that causes oxidative stress. So this is a good way of showing that oxidative stress is important, because who were the people that we saw the virus affecting the most? People with disorders of the mitochondria. So people who were obese, people who had high blood pressure, people who had kidney disease, people who had all of these metabolic issues that we see in industrialized countries. Well, what they did in Brazil was a study where they took patients in the hospital with COVID-19 and they put on them a jacket, this vest, that was literally made out of basically near-infrared LED bulbs. Now, I say LED because these LEDs were specifically designed. Unlike the LED bulbs in our homes, these were designed to emit at around 920 nanometers, which is in the near-infrared range. Not only did these patients benefit from COVID, from the near-infrared, they were also discharged 4 days earlier on average than those that had the jackets on, but the lights were just not turned on.
Amazing, right? So
yeah, I mean, it was, so they had better pulmonary function tests. They had better white blood cell. This was a randomized controlled trial. This was not an associative trial. This was a randomized controlled trial. And in this trial, you could not see when the lights were on, right? Because it's near infrared, you can't see that. So no one could really tell if they were getting the treatment or not. So it was completely randomized. Everybody put the jackets on, but only half of them randomized got the lights actually turned on. And there was a significant improvement. Of course, in terms of studies, we know this. We knew this, not for COVID, but just in general. People in hospitals, in their hospital rooms, if there are two beds, the bed closest to the window that had light coming in, on average, those patients left the hospital more quickly.
Well, that certainly makes sense. And you said they had their jackets on. What?
Well, these are the jackets with the LED lights.
Oh,
so
gotcha.
The intervention.
Okay.
Yeah, this vest or this jacket that they put on, both the control arm and the intervention arm had it on, but they turned the lights actually on the vest that were directed toward the skin.
Okay.
Only in the intervention arm.
I didn't understand if they were just sitting under some kind of LED light. And then back to the windows where you were talking about the schools, Roger, does all the light come through? Isn't there some light missing when you're only getting light through a window?
Yeah, so we have, through technology, advanced the science of windows for the better in some instances, but also to our detriment if you look at the whole thing. So near-infrared light is a warming light, and so when that sort of light comes into a room, it heats up that room. So what scientists have done is they've designed windows called low-E windows that are specifically designed to filter out or to block that light from coming in. It really helps on cooling costs in buildings if you don't have to cool down the place because near-infrared light's not coming in. But the problem is that if you are inside that home and you would need to get infrared light at some point because that's really the healing aspect of that light, you're not going to get it inside. Furthermore, we have also changed the lights in our home for the same reason. So a lot of energy goes into incandescent bulbs that go into a portion of the portion of the spectrum that we can't see. So that would be a waste of energy. There's a lot of, in other words, incandescent bulbs produce a lot of near-infrared light that we can't see. And so the LED bulb uses far less electricity but only produces light in the visible spectrum. So we're not getting near-infrared from LED bulbs in our home. We're not getting near-infrared radiation through the windows. The only way to get near-infrared radiation is to go outside.
Well, I don't have a problem with doing that. Maybe if I lived in the Arctic in the winter or something. But so you spoke about the incandescent bulbs. Is this the best kind of lighting to get for your house?
It depends on what you mean by best. I guess in terms of if you're looking at spectrum light, that would be good. It would be nice to be able to get what the term now is complete biological spectrum. Complete biological spectrum. So you're getting a lot of visible light, but you're also getting near-infrared light. And full disclosure, I talked to you about Russell Reiter, who is a scientist looking at melatonin. The other gentleman, Dr. Scott Zimmerman, he's actually the head of a light bulb company that's actually trying to produce bulbs that meet this criteria, that are energy efficient, but also give you the complete biological spectrum of light. And so, yes, they are working on this. The current LED bulbs, the advantage with those are that they use less electricity, but they don't give you near-infrared. And, of course, the incandescent bulbs, which, by the way, in some states are actually being outlawed in terms of sales, they, of course, give you the full spectrum, biological spectrum, but they are also a lot more energy inefficient because of that.
That's amazing that it's gotten to that point of energy efficiency instead of what, well, it's all the invisible things that are going on that seem to get ignored, right?
Exactly.
Well, talk to us about being in the sunshine and how your body works within that and absorbs that. I know there's a lot to be said about not necessarily having to be in the bright sunshine, that plants actually have a way of reflecting for us. And how does that all work?
Yeah, so we know very early on that plants absorb red and blue light, but that's colored red and blue light. They need that for photosynthesis. What is not apparent, and what is actually now being more fully understood, is that they particularly reflect near infrared light. So if you are outside on a sunny day, yes, you are going to get a certain amount of near infrared light, even if you're downtown amongst the buildings, although you're probably not going to get as much. If, however, you are out on a sunny day in a field, in a pasture, where there's grass, where there are trees, that light that's coming down is going to reflect off of those trees' leaves, and you're going to get an actual even more amount of near-infrared light because it reflects that light to your body, and you're going to get more. You know this intuitively, because on a hot summer day, you know as soon as you go under the canopy of a tree, it gets very cool under there, and that's because those leaves are reflecting that near-infrared light, the heat, away from underneath the tree. So if you're under the tree, you're going to get very little near-infrared light. But if you're outside the green pastures, the green grass, the green trees are going to reflect that. And there is decades of literature that shows that people who walk in green pastures and outside in nature, they actually have better health. They have less anxiety. They have all of the metabolic factors that we would want to see in somebody. There was recently a study that was published where they looked at two cities, one city in England, Oxfordshire, where Oxford University is, and another one called Leiden in the Netherlands. And what they did was they drew people's blood throughout the year, and they controlled it for season. And they asked a very simple question. They asked, In the previous 7 days to having these subjects' blood drawn, what was the weather like in those locales? In other words, how much sun was there in just the past 7 days prior to the blood draw? And they found that there was a correlation that the more sun there was in the previous 7 days, the better the insulin resistance was and the better the triglycerides and the cholesterol was in these patients in just those previous 7 days. So getting outside into the sun can have that much of a benefit in that short a period of time.
It's amazing. So I've always had a hard time thinking that being out in the sun is harmful. So can you shed some light on, no pun intended there, or
yeah,
shed some wisdom perhaps onto that topic and what you recommend for people?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. So I don't want to run afoul of what people have heard from the dermatologist, and I actually think that there is room for agreement on this. The ionizing energy from the sun that is the most dangerous to the human being is in the ultraviolet range. Unfortunately, that's also where we get vitamin D production. So it is possible that you can supplement with vitamin D and eliminate that aspect of it. I would say that taking vitamin D, by the way, is not a substitute for getting out in the sun. But what you want to avoid is ultraviolet radiation. Now, fortunately, ultraviolet radiation is pretty weak. I mean, it has a lot of ionizing radiation that can cause damage to your skin, but it doesn't penetrate very well. So just putting clothes on and avoiding the sun between the hours of 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. will go a long way at minimizing ultraviolet radiation exposure to your skin. So if you're concerned about the damaging effects of the sun, avoiding the sun between 10 o'clock in the morning and 2 p.m. in the afternoon, and making sure that you're covering up. Now, you don't have to worry that covering up is going to minimize your infrared, which is very beneficial because, remember, as we said, infrared light is very good at penetrating those layers. If you look at the whole system, though, this is really interesting, is if you can imagine somebody being outside the whole day, it's got a built-in system with that. So because as the sun is coming up in the morning, you're getting large amounts of near-infrared radiation. What is this doing? It's building up melatonin in your skin. It's building up all of those antioxidants, preparing it for the onslaught of radicals that's going to come in between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., which is ultraviolet. So that you're building up the shields, so you're able to go through 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. pretty well. And then after 2 p.m., again, you're getting mostly just infrared radiation as the sun goes lower and lower in the sky, and you're mopping up all of the damage that may have occurred. So it's all sort of built into the system. Where you have a problem is if you're inside the whole day in the morning, and then you get outside at noon, like say for lunch, and now you haven't had a chance to build up this melatonin build up in your body to take care of hydroxy radicals. You expose yourself to ultraviolet radiation, get damage, and then when that damage is supposed to be healed, what do? You go back inside for the rest of the afternoon and not get those healing near-infrared rays. So that's what you want to kind of avoid to do. Just be cognizant of that.
Of course. And how convenient that nature made sunsets and sunrises so beautiful. Who wouldn't want to be out in those, right?
It's amazing. You know, I was just in Naples, Florida, for a business trip, and we went down to the beach. And of course, the west coast of Florida, you can see sunsets, and it was just an absolutely gorgeous event. And everyone was out there on the beach watching the sun go down. So you're right.
Yeah, that's the nighttime.
And of course, it makes sense, right? Because it's red.
Yes.
You're getting plenty of near infrared.
Yes, and that's the big show. You know, it's like, what else is there to do if you're at the beach except go down at and gather at sunset, right? It's just amazing. And share a little bit about the blue light, that artificial light that, you know, as you just mentioned, it's good if you can get out for the sunset, but then we go indoors, and I've seen that you really recommend not having a lot of light in the evenings, and especially right up until bedtime. And of course, you know, no one's going to, I don't know many that will do this perfectly, but it's good to know the basic facts anyway.
Yeah, so now we're going to talk about a completely different aspect of light. This is the visible light now that we can actually see. And why is this important? It's because our bodies are on a clock called the circadian rhythm. So if you can imagine, your body is very complex, and it's way more complex than Disneyland, for instance. But let's talk about Disneyland for just a minute as an analogy. You go there in the daytime, there's rides, there are people at the concession stands. Disneyland is a completely different world at night, because at night the place is closed down, there's no customers. But this is when the trash gets taken out. This is when the cash registers get emptied. This is when the mechanics go onto the rides. And so any kind of complex system that needs repair and rest is going to have a perfect time of the day when everything comes in and does its job, right? You don't want the gardener coming in during the business hours when the customers are there. And you don't want the ride to be shut down for repair while you have customers. And the body is the same way. The circadian rhythm governs all of those processes in the body. And we're starting to find out that this is actually much more important than we used to think. For instance, even medication side effects are more pronounced at certain times of the day than at others. So there's an optimal time to get a medication. There's an optimal time to eat. There's an optimal time to sleep. And if you're doing all of these things correctly, your body is swimming downstream. It's so easy. If you do it incorrectly, you're swimming upstream. Just imagine, I live within the area of Los Angeles, and imagine if someone were to tell me, I need you to go into L.A. Now, that would be a much different job if he told me to go into L.A. at 7 o'clock in the morning versus going into L.A. at 10 o'clock at night. Those are completely different jobs, even though it's the same distance, and it's because of traffic and circadian rhythm. Right. So with that being said, the biggest stimulus and regulator of your circadian rhythm is light. And so if you're not using light to your advantage, you're going to be swimming upstream. So let's talk about light and how that works. Light is going to shift your circadian rhythm, and it's going to impact your ability to sleep in negative or positive ways, depending on when you apply that light. So if you apply that light early in the morning, and we're talking about typically blue light, the type of light that is the most stimulating to your circadian rhythm, but all light will do it. if you expose your eyes to bright light, blue light in the morning, it has the tendency to shift your circadian rhythm a little bit earlier. And that's actually something that's pretty beneficial in today's society, because the problem that we all have is that, you know, society and culturally, we get home from work, we turn on the television, we eat late, which, by the way, is not the right time to eat for our circadian rhythm.
Right.
And what happens is we're constantly under this influence of shifting our circadian rhythm later and later and later. Because why? Because of artificial light that our body was not intended to have exposed to after 9 o'clock at night. And so instead of getting ready to fall asleep and be tired at 9, 10, 11 o'clock, which is when the circadian rhythm would normally do it, it's now at 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. And so if you want to get your 7 or 8 hours of sleep, which everyone tells you to do, and you know that you have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, then you're going to want to go to bed at 10 o'clock. Well, the problem is that you're not ready to sleep because you've been exposing your eyes to bright light all this time. And so you have the primary symptom of insomnia, not being able to sleep. So you finally go to sleep at around 11 or 12, but you still have to get up at 5 because you got to beat the traffic to get in to work in the morning. And what happens? Your circadian rhythm is still saying, we need to sleep till 7 or 8. And so you have hypersomnia, or you have what we call sleep inertia in the morning. And so what's happened is that our good hours of sleep have been reduced. We're getting less sleep. Our circadian rhythm has become delayed. And light at night is also reducing. To harken back to our original topic, melatonin, which is how you take care of your mitochondria when there is no sun. It's the backup system that we get at night to make sure that we're not getting oxidative stress at night.
Just like you said with Disney World, so much of the healing process happens at night. So all of this just
exactly fits
so well, doesn't it? And just a quick question, what would you find the benefits of supplemental melatonin?
Yeah, so supplemental melatonin has some pitfalls. Number one, in the United States, it's a nutritional supplement, so it's not regulated. We don't know if it is actually melatonin that we're getting in these supplements. Unless you buy from a company that's well reputable and actually has a third party come in and actually analyze the supplement. So make sure that you do that. U.S. Laboratories, I think, is one way of checking to make sure that they've actually made sure that that's in there. The second thing is that melatonin is a great supplement to take in small doses. So there is this paradoxical thing with melatonin supplementation. If you go much above 5 or 10 milligrams, and I usually tell my patients, take, you know, less than 5, there is a paradoxical response, meaning that you get the opposite effect. People become more irritated. They have a harder time sleeping if they go much above 3 to 5 milligrams of melatonin. And I would only take it at night because even though we talked about melatonin when the sun is up, being produced in the mitochondria, and we've talked about melatonin being produced in the pineal gland if there's no light at night, these are very different in the very different areas of the body. So in the daytime when the sun is hitting you, this melatonin is existing inside the mitochondria itself. It's not circulating out into the blood, generally speaking. However, at night, when the pineal gland is making melatonin, if you're not being exposed to light at night, this melatonin is going into the circulatory system and is actually a signal for the body that it's time to go to sleep. This is the reason why I would only recommend, if you're going to take melatonin as a supplement, you take it about an hour before you are planning on going to sleep, and don't take high doses of it.
Great, thank you. And Roger, you have a variety of medical board certifications. Do you have either a favorite aspect of your work or some sort of research that is piquing your interest right now?
Yeah, so I do have board certifications in internal medicine, pulmonary critical, and also sleep medicine. But this idea about light is very dear to me. And other interventions that are very simple and are very scalable. And the reason for that is because one of the lessons I learned in the pandemic is that, yes, we have medications. Yes, we have interventions that we can do medically. And I have no hesitation in using those in the intensive care unit. But under a pandemic response, what I find is the issue is that the scalability of an intervention is a problem. And if we have another pandemic, it would be best to be prepared for that, but also to look for things that are easily and locally available, things like sunlight, things like hydrotherapy, I think this is what we ought to be understanding more of. So if we run into this situation again, we can provide the benefits for everybody and not have to worry about the logistics and scalability of these interventions.
For anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.